Thank you for downloading this Great Lives podcast from BBC Radio 4. For more information and details of other podcasts, just visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Hello and welcome to Great Lives. My guest today is Lord Digby Jones, and he has a very particular reason for choosing his great life. Digby, tell us what you remember as a little boy in 1965.
I have a memory of a very cold January day and coming in from school, and there were Mum and Dad in tears, and Winston Churchill had died. He then lay in state in Westminster Hall, and they went down to London and joined the queue in the freezing cold and walked past Churchill's coffin and paid their due respects to the man that they acknowledged had saved their country. And then came the day of Winston Churchill's funeral, and everybody in the street gathered round the one TV which was in our shop, and we watched this fabulous Englishman, the greatest Englishman in my view that ever lived. And I can remember all the cranes coming down in pay respect, like lowering of huge battle ensigns as the funeral barge went past.
Also with us, Professor David Reynolds has memories of that time as well.
Yes, I grew up in Kent, so my family had also revered Churchill, and we watched the funeral on television. And rather on impulse, my father and I went up to Waterloo and watched the train leave for Bladen, taking his coffin.
So our great life today is that of Winston Churchill. Quite remarkably, a great life whom no guest on this programme has chosen before. We're going to have to move fast. Let's give up even the attempt at a comprehensive sweep. Let me instead briefly and first introduce our proposer, Digby Jones. He's former Director General of the CBI and a former Minister of State for Trade and Investment. He's now a peer and sits on the crossbenches in the House of Lords. He's also an ambassador for UK business. Digby, tell us what Churchill means to you now.
I'd sum it up in one word, is inspiration, actually. I've found huge inspiration in my own life through all of Churchill's life, in so many different facets. And, of course, not all good things. It is rather nice to see and satisfying to acknowledge that he made loads of mistakes, and his judgment was flawed often. And I take inspiration from that as well, because, you know, as I led the law firm in Birmingham, and then when I led the CBI, and when I even today go round the world banging the drum for British business, you know, you're in a position of leadership in an absolute minuscule, an infinitesimally minuscule way compared with Churchill. But nevertheless, I get inspiration from him in his finest hours and also in some of his worst ones.
In a word, if he made loads of mistakes, if his judgment was often wrong, what was great about him?
He got the British people to believe in themselves. That is the essence of leadership. More than anything else, you have to get people who doubt they can to do it. And in that, there has never been, and in my view, someone's got to go some to prove there is ever going to be again, a person who could do it like he could do it.
David Reynolds is the Professor of International History at Cambridge University. Known to Radio 4 listeners as the writer and presenter of America, Empire of Liberty, he's also written extensively on Churchill, including the book In Command of History, about Churchill's memoirs of World War II. Professor Reynolds, how do you feel about Churchill after immersing yourself so thoroughly in his life and his writings?
Well, I think a real fascination for the man. And in a way, what Digby said rings true for me. My problem with, as it were, the conventional image of Churchill is that he's two-dimensional. He's a kind of icon on the wall of British history. What fascinates me is the three-dimensional man, warts and all. And I think that Churchill can stand scrutiny, close scrutiny, because if you see him as a rounded human being with his faults and his virtues, you actually have a greater sense of what he achieved and why he was a remarkable human being.
I asked Lord Jones what, in a word, his greatness was. You too speak of his flaws, of warts and all, and all the rest. Can you put your finger, in just a few words, on the weakness, the flaw, or the weaknesses, the flaws?
in some ways, the strengths are the other side of the weaknesses. People said again and again of Winston, you know, that he was a person of incredible energy, who threw himself into everything that he did, 100%, even more, and that was sometimes actually a sign that he hadn't got good judgment, that he wasn't wise. These were the criticisms that were often thrown at him. But when he got something right, that energy, that commitment, that passion was what carried him through and I think communicated itself to other people. I mean, I remember talking to a number of people who were Churchill's secretaries, and you got a sense that the working life was intolerable, but you wouldn't have missed it for the world because there was this incredible buzz around this man. And then he had this wonderful gift occasionally for just suddenly sort of noticing you and saying something very kind or thoughtful that illuminated the day and so on.
Let's start at the beginning. Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill was born at Blenheim Palace on the 30th of November, 1874. His father, Lord Randolph Churchill, was the third son of the 7th Duke and a descendant of John Churchill, 1st Duke of Marlborough. So he was a real aristocrat. It makes the kerfuffle over David Cameron having been at Eton look a bit tame. Mm-hmm. He'd never have got onto David Cameron's A-list now, would he?
You don't know, do you? Because the force of personality and the ability, and of course of the time, would have probably won through. I'm not too sure he's on Lord Halifax's A-list, actually. The establishment never did like him. You say he was an aristocrat, but the aristocrats didn't like him.
No, there was a sort of... The other side of him was, of course, that he was regarded as half-American at a time, because of his mother, at a time when that was, not necessarily a good thing. And also, he didn't come from a particularly landed family. He made his money from journalism, and a lot of people thought of him as a kind of opportunist. So there was this feeling that there was something sort of shady and plutocratic about him.
I think it's very widely known that he wasn't much good at school. On the other hand, he can't possibly have been stupid. What kind of intelligence do you think he had?
I think it was instinctive. I think it needed a set of circumstances. He was definitely a man of action. He got bored incredibly quickly.
But he was also a man who worked hard at things. He had an enormous industry, an application, so that, for example, having really basically failed at school...
Never went to university.
Never went to university. But he worked, particularly when he was in the army, he worked in India at a huge amount of self-education, of reading, of learning. He had a formidable memory, which he trained and developed. And also, I think, partly because he hadn't been at university in a way, he didn't think sequentially. He thought laterally. He was actually extremely good at connecting up one thing and another in a way that infuriated people who had a slightly more orderly form of mind. But that was a really important part of him. Also, of course, he had a fascination for gadgets. He was technically interested. Again, not in a scientific way, but, you know, he has claims to have been at the forefront of things like the tank and so on. He was fascinated by technologies in the Second World War. And that's another part of his intelligence, I think.
It's interesting, but given he suffered a great deal of parental rejection, you know, these...
Tell us just a bit about...
Well, these letters that you often read of, his letters, begging to come home for holidays, and father basically saying we're not here, and this sort of thing. Usually, that gives rise to a wish, an ache to please, an ache to seek approval for the rest of your life. And interestingly, a lot of his conduct was above seeking approval, was incredibly full of self-certainty. Whether inside, he was a depressive, and whether inside he had enormous self-doubt, but he never ever once acted in a way that sought approval. And in fact, somebody said, didn't they, that Churchill to consult his party would be like a chauffeur consulting his motor car. And yet, usually somebody who suffers from this enormous parental rejection tends to be an approval seeker all their lives. Funnily enough, when he was asked by his grandchildren just before he died, do you have any regrets? And he said, I wish my father had been around to see that I actually turned out okay.
Take us in a couple of sentences, Professor Reynolds, through the army stage of his career, starting at Sandhurst, was it?
Yeah, I mean, it's really important, I think, for the Second World War that this is a man who actually saw military service. He was involved in probably the last charge of the great charge of the British Army at Omdurman. He probably killed people. You know, he certainly knew battle. And that was tremendously important for him. But he never, I think, imagined that he would stay in the army. The army was a way of... he used his connections to become a military correspondent, and he saw his path as following his father, and I think also, in a sense, doing what his father hadn't been able to do, in other words, to rise through politics to the very top. I think from an early stage, he saw himself as a future prime minister. He was delighted to become Chancellor of the Exchequer, as his father had done, but he intended to go further than that.
He went off to the Boer War as a war correspondent.
As a war correspondent. Yeah. And then, of course, the celebrated arrest and imprisonment and escape from captivity, and back to London. Then he went into politics, and his appointment as First Lord of the Admiralty ended in a degree of disgrace when he, the Dardanelles campaign, and ending with the tragedy of Gallipoli, was by and large down to him. And he resigned very shortly thereafter. And what does he do? He actually enlists, he signs up. He goes to the Western Front as a major, becomes a lieutenant colonel, and he actually is at the front for 7 or 8 months. Now, that's the equivalent today of the Secretary of State for Defence, of whom we have had many in the last 10 years.
Yes, quite. You can't imagine it, can you?
And saying, oh, well, you know, I've resigned. I'm going to enlist and go to Kabul. This was a guy who really believed what he actually did. He sent his men into war as a democratically elected politician, and then when it all went wrong, something inside him said, well, I'll go and do what I've actually been talking about. That, for me, actually, is an enormous source of inspiration.
Would the Conservative Party, David, have been an automatic for someone coming from where he came from?
Well, I mean, he's following his father's footsteps, but the important thing about Churchill's political career, as far as others perceive him, is that he's a turncoat. He's seen as a political opportunist because he becomes a liberal over the issue of free trade. And then after the First World War, when the Liberal Party collapses, Churchill moves back to the Conservatives because he now believes the fundamental divide in British politics is whether you're a socialist or not.
This is BBC Radio 4, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest this week, Digby Jones, has chosen the great life of Winston Churchill. To help us is Professor David Reynolds. Now, what happened in the couple of decades that followed? How could it be that he was considered a failure and a busted flush by the late 1930s?
He's out of office from 1929, and he is, in a sense, looking for causes that will get him back into office. So he champions the king during the abdication crisis, which is generally regarded as a really rather quixotic kind of thing to do, over the question of India and giving some degree of self-government to India. He leads the sort of diehard part of the Conservative Party at a time when, you know, most of the Conservatives are in favour of doing this. So when he starts out talking about the German air threat, which he does with the same kind of energy and vigour, there is a tendency to feel that he is OTT again. Arthur Balfour, the former Prime Minister, once said to him, Winston, he said, I admire the exaggerated way you tell the truth. And that was part of Churchill's problem until after Munich, until after the Munich settlement goes wrong in the winter of 38-39. Then Churchill's star rises because
like
he is vindicated.
But like weapons of mass destruction.
Inspiration I get from him in this time, he must have stood in front of the mirror and thought, well, no one else is going to believe in you.
So did Hitler, Digby.
That is a very valid point. Yes, but the self-belief that this guy had to sustain him through a time when everybody else in a democracy, rather than in Germany, was telling him he was wrong, I find that very inspirational.
So he's proved right on the German threat. He becomes Prime Minister, and in 1940, France surrendered, and Churchill faces the devastating truth that Britain is going to have to fight Germany alone. Listen to this.
The Battle of France. It's over. I expect that the Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. Let us, therefore, brace ourselves to our duties, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
Wow. Do you know, I must have heard that 1,000 times and it still gets the hairs going up on the back of my neck and I still get a lump in my throat and I'm still so passionately proud of being British.
One of the things that I remember very vividly finding in the archives was an account given by General Ismay, Hastings Ismay, who was Churchill's military secretary, right-hand man, of what happened 6 days before that speech. The speech was the 18th of June. 12th of June, Churchill goes to see the French for what proves to be the last but one time, and it's absolutely clear they're going to sue for an armistice in the next few days. And he and Ismay then drive back to the airfield in France, and Churchill's in the car, and he's looking pretty glum, and Ismay tries to cheer him up, and he says, well, you know, OK, the Battle of France is over, we'll win the Battle of Britain. And Churchill looks at him and he says, you and I will be dead in 3 months' time. Now, when I read that in the archives, it's one of these sort of light bulb moments. You turn over lots of papers and suddenly something really hits you. Now, that wasn't Churchill's view for the whole of the summer of 1940. But on that day, he could see the magnitude of the task ahead of him. He, in a sense, looked into the abyss. And yet 6 days later, he could stand up in the House of Commons and then later on the radio and say, if the British Empire lasts for 1,000 years, men will say that's our finest hour. Now, that for me is the sign of leadership.
Totally right.
That's, you know, that John Keegan wrote a book called The Mask of Command, and that, you know, a leader sometimes has to put on a mask, a face that isn't necessarily the true heart of him at that moment, to inspire and so on. And for me, that was when I began to feel, yes, you know, this is an impressive man because he can see the magnitude of what's there and yet he can come up and say, we're going to win.
And I think that's an enormous lesson to all of us.
Yes, but this brings me to the question I've been itching to ask you, Digby Jones, since right at the beginning you said what you so admired about him was that he could look in the mirror and say, I believe in you, I believe in myself. Did he? Or did he look in the mirror and say, this is all pretty dire, but if I say so, it's all going to get even more dire, therefore I will put on the mask of command, and though I doubt, I will not convey my doubts, because that's two very different readings.
I think those two views are compatible. I think he did go into that speech with that mask, and inside his doubts were strong, but he could still believe in himself as the person who was fit to do it, as the only person who was fit to do it.
He hasn't got the rational basis for a strategy for victory. Churchill's strategy, as he liked to put it privately, is KBO. Keep buggering on in the hope that something will turn up, but his gut feeling is that somehow we can hang on.
You, both of you, in your slightly different ways, described a very important quality in Churchill, the ability to turn what was at best only a hope into what sounded like confidence. This niggling doubt troubles me. They're not very far from the qualities of a shyster or a confidence trickster.
Oh, for sure. You can see that in people who are up to no good as well.
Can I put to both of you the same question? The great man in history. I think you believe, Digby Jones, that without Churchill it wouldn't have happened, that the accident of one man in history was something upon which history eventually turned. Am I right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Well, I think that Churchill was extremely important in 1940 for galvanising the British war effort. It was said again and again in Whitehall that, you know, Winston just got the machine moving in a way that had never happened before, and also for acting as an inspirational focus for the British people. The war, however, is a long one. By 1942, there's a lot of mutterings that Winston was the man for the job in 1940, but maybe he's too old now. The victory at Alamein in November 1942 in the Western Desert means that Churchill will be the leader for the rest of the war. But there's a strong sense by the end of it that the country is looking for different people, for different approaches, for a fresh attitude to reconstruction and so on. Yes. So I think Churchill matters in 1940. Whether he is such an important presence for the whole of the war, I think, is a more open question.
I think you could... he was universal and omnipotent in 1940. For 1943 and 4, it's fading, and I think you're right. But by 45, I think it's taken on a completely different hue. But he was very much, or should I say the country, is very much the junior partner in Tehran and then in Yalta. I mean, very much the junior partner. And Uncle Joe and FDR are very much the people who are going to carve up a post-45 Europe. But his personal standing, because of what he did in 1940, is enormous. So he actually punched way above his weight. Britain would never have got the same status and standing in 45 as it
got. I don't think I really agree. I mean, I think Churchill has a strong sense of how weak a set of cards he's playing by 1945. And there's a limited amount that he can do, and he confesses that.
I'm with you on that. I'm especially interested, though, in that point in 1940, 41, of which Digby Jones speaks. Did he make the difference? And if he hadn't lived, would we not have won the war? Would we have lost? Would we have collapsed? Would we have not been able to hold on until Churchill had managed to help bring the Americans in? Was one man critical, and did it matter that it was Churchill?
I don't think one man is decisively critical in the way that you have just described. I think there's a whole variety of other factors as well. But Churchill's presence in 1940 and his effect in 1940 was an enormous part of why we got through.
But if you analyse leadership of any situation, the leader, and you break it down into component parts, the leader didn't do it all on his own, and without other people around or a bit of serendipity, the leader would never ever have delivered it. But if you put all the other things in the pot, take the leader out and put another person in, you can have as many ingredients as you like and you won't make the stew. So in that respect, I actually would slightly disagree with David. I would say he was not only vital, but if he had not been there as the person, not just as a prime minister, but with his qualities, we would have been suing for peace with a Nazi regime, and the terms would have been appalling, and you can forget everything that you and I take for granted.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that is critical in 1940 is what has been put in place several years before, and that is a successful system of fighters and radar that enable us to intercept the German bombers coming across the channel. That means that the Germans are not in a position to get air supremacy. If they can't get air supremacy, there cannot be an invasion in 1940. Once you get into 1941, then there is a relief in the sense that the Russians are in the war. That takes the pressure off to begin with. Then the Americans come in. So in a sense, getting through 1940 is a critical part of the story. And that was not just to do with one man. It was to do with things that had been put in place technologically some years before.
Where, Digby Jones, does it come from? I'm not asking you to compare yourself with Churchill, but you are also a confident person. At times you may be aware of a little bit of bravado coming into it. That's what makes it work. That's what make people believe in you. That's why you're such a good public speaker. That's why you're so good at rallying people. And Churchill in spades did that. Where does it come from? Do you ever look in the mirror and ask, how is it that I suddenly get this confidence, that the confidence that communicates itself to other people?
I'm glad you said that you're not asking me to compare myself with Churchill. This is on a very, very small scale. But you have to believe in what you're talking about. I mean, although the mask can come down, and I was a lawyer for 20 years, so often you argue a case that you're not entirely certain is the strongest you've ever dealt with. But you do have to believe. I think, secondly, you have to identify with the people to whom you're talking. So, for instance, Churchill had been at the front in the First World War. He had been a prisoner of war. He had sat on a horse and killed people. I'm not saying that's a good or bad thing. I'm merely saying he had. So he could identify with it. And I think in the speeches I give and what I do identify with the people who are listening to me. And then I think, thirdly, you can hone it. You can get better at it. You can learn from the mistakes you invariably make when you're doing it. But there's a little bit of you that actually you're born that way.
Mm.
And I think a bit of the a bit of the arrogance and a bit of the conceit and a bit of the bravado, I do actually think that probably there's a little bit inside me of that rather than just things that I can pick up. The other thing you have to be is a very quick learner. You have to understand and sense and feel when something's going wrong and act accordingly and don't carry on. What's the old cliche? When you're in a hole, you had better stop digging, whatever you do.
Now, standing back for a moment from the war and looking at the Churchill that you say, whose image still helps sell Britain abroad, the archetypal Englishman, John Bull, the bulldog, and all the rest, was he seen, and do you see him, as an archetypal Englishman?
We are at this moment going through one of our sort of identity crises, aren't we? And I mean, it was fashionable some years ago to denounce Churchill and only talk about the nasty side. And at this moment, we're having a bit of a problem working out where we stand in the world again. But as I've gone around the world for the CBI and then for the Minister of State for Trade and Investment and now as a UK business ambassador, I have formed the view that there is only one country actually that deeply, deeply doesn't like us, and it's us. We have a pretty low opinion of ourselves. And most countries, they see us as arrogant, they see us as pretty slow, but they actually attach themselves to our values and understand them. I'm not saying they always practice them, but they do understand them very, very quickly. And a conversation about our values, such as democracy and fairness, good partnering and all of that, You don't, especially in the small hours, you don't have a conversation about that in most places in the world without the person at some point from the other country mentioning Churchill's name, because he stood for it. And one thing I think that really shows this was 1945, and I think the British electorate got it absolutely right. You know, this guy was utterly exhausted. He wasn't that good at peacetime and never was. And instinctively, the British public understood that and voted for a completely different way of doing Britain. And one of Churchill's remarks that day was, well, I guess that's what we were fighting for.
We're running out of time and we've hardly scratched the surface. I'm simply not up to offering a neat summary of our conclusions on Churchill's greatness, and maybe nobody should try. My thanks to Digby Jones, who's chosen The Great Life of Winston Churchill, and to Professor David Reynolds. Goodbye.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this Great Lives podcast. Many other BBC programmes are available as podcasts. You can find details at bbc.co.uk/radio4.